following program is brought to you in living color on
DailyGazette.com or wherever you get your podcast.
The Daily Gazette Company presents the Parting Shots Podcast. Now, here's your host, Daily Gazette sports editor, Ken Schott.
Thank you, Scott Giese, and welcome to the Parting Shots Podcast. Available wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe today. Thanks for joining me from the Parting Shots Podcast studio in Schenectady, New York. Back after a week off. I wasn't planning to take some podcast time off last week, but spent part of early last week down in Philadelphia helping out with things for my mother, who had knee replacement surgery. She's rehabbing right now and getting better and stronger each day. I'm glad that's happening. So I got back early during the week, and I just didn't have time to set anything up for interviews. So I apologize for that. But we're back and have a great podcast coming up for you. I spoke with new Siena women's basketball coach Terry Prim on Tuesday. You'll have that interview coming up in just a couple minutes. Joe Yurden will talk Buffalo Sabres hockey and the firing of a head coach Don Granato and what's going to happen with the Sabres as they try to figure out why they haven't made the playoffs for the last 13 years. And then New York Post sports columnist Mike Vaccaro joins me. We're going to talk on a variety of New York sports topics, including the rather surprising announcement on Monday that John Sterling announced he's retiring from his duties as Yankee play-by-play man on the radio. He had been backing off of some of his assignments over the last couple of years, but retirement seems to come at an odd time, but we'll talk about that along with the New York Knicks, Yankees, Mets, and Rangers. It was a nice conversation I had with Mike. He's making his debut here on the Parting Shots podcast. Well, coming up, Terry Prim, the new Siena women's basketball coach, will join me. We'll talk about his role taking over for Jim Jaber. You're listening to the Parting Shots podcast.
In school sports, it's easy to see the wins, the moments that make headlines. But there's so much work that goes unseen for any of it to happen. My name is Phil Risen, and I'm the executive director of the National Interscholastic Athletic Administrators Association. Throughout the country, athletic administrators dedicate countless hours to making life-changing opportunities possible for student athletes through sports. Their sacrifice is fueled by the belief that every student can grow and deserves their time to shine. On behalf of the NIAAA, we want to thank every athletic administrator for your tireless dedication to providing 7.8 million students across the country a path to a better future.
This message presented by the NIAAA, the National Interscholastic Athletic Administrators Association.
Want to get all the latest news from the Daily Gazette on your phone or tablet? We have an app for that. The Daily Gazette app allows you to read all the newspaper stories and columns from our dedicated team of journalists. The app is free. You can download the app from the Apple or Google app stores.
Hi, this is Tri-City Valley Cats General Manager Matt Callahan. You're listening to the Parting Shots podcast with Daily Gazette sports editor Ken Schott.
Welcome back to the podcast. The Siena women's basketball team has a new head coach in Terry Prim. He had been the assistant under Jim Jaber at Siena, and of course, before that at Florida Atlantic. Terry was named the head coach on April 5th, and he was formally introduced on Monday at the UHY Center on the Siena College campus. I was over there to shoot some video for the paper, and if you had a chance to see it on our YouTube page on the Daily Gazette, you can check that out there. And on Tuesday, I sat down with Terry on an interview, and we discussed this hiring. So here's my interview with new Siena women's basketball coach Terry Prim.
Well, Terry, I appreciate a few minutes. First of all, congratulations, and how does it feel to be the head coach of the Siena women's basketball team?
Thanks, Ken. No, it's an honor. The transition's been smooth. I feel like I've been prepared for this moment for a long time. And so from that sense, it's just business as usual, a couple of added responsibilities. But outside of that, it's been great.
Yeah. I was at the press conference on Monday over at Siena, and I asked you the question, do you feel you're ready? Do you feel you're ready for this?
Absolutely. And actually have been doing a lot of the responsibilities leading up to this point. And I think those games that I coached, those seven games, I didn't really put a lot of stock into it in terms of the adjustment I would need to make. But I think it happened so seamlessly that afterwards, reflecting back on it, it made me feel really positive about an opportunity should it present itself in the future, and I'm glad it did here at Siena.
Yeah, I know the players really were supporting you. They were hoping I can't pronounce her first name, but the players at
Anaja.
Thank you. I was having one that slipped to my tongue, but she said it to Mike McAdam from the beginning of the hiring process. We were all rooting for Terry to become the next head coach. Every single one of the players gave their vote of confidence in Terry, and we truly appreciate them taking that into consideration. How good was it to feel that you had the support of the players?
It's all about them. And so it feels great whenever you get some feedback from them that you're moving in the right direction in terms of their care and support, because it's their time. I say this a lot as coaches. I'm so fascinated by how much attention coaches get when it's the players that, really have the lion's share of the work. They have to buy in. They have to adjust. They're constantly growing and evolving. And that's not an easy process. If you ask anybody on how easy it is to change, it's not easy. And for them to go through that and just trust any approach that I had, absorb any word that I had for them, it just made me feel good. So I was glad to hear that, I was doing some things right.
Yeah. I mean, how much support did you get from Jim Jaber, your former boss?
Well, I don't think this happens without Jim, and not just during the process, but just in his leadership approach and preparing his assistants for the next level and giving all opportunity to grow as much as he possibly could. So, I really don't think this happens without him on every level.
What did you learn from Jim?
I learned that you should always be in a growth space in terms of whatever your philosophy is, your playing style is, the way you teach, what you teach, it should always be up for discussion. And something else that kind of aligns with the concept that I learned from the Bible is if it's a good word, it could be the rock speaking it. And we're going to listen to it. So it doesn't necessarily have to come from the resident expert. If it's a good word, we're going to take it into consideration. So that was probably the biggest thing. And I'd say also maybe unspoken, but something I recognize with Jim is he's probably one of the more self-aware people I've ever been around. Some people want to be the expert. They want to be the person on top, and they're always projecting that, especially in the social media time that we're living in. But Jim, was humble enough to always express the real of the situation. So if he didn't know something, he didn't mind saying, "I don't know." If he felt a certain way about something, he could figure out a way to express that and be real about it. And so I don't think I've been with anybody that's been able to do that as well as he has, and it had a profound effect on me.
Yeah, your relationship with Jim goes back to the Florida Atlantic University days in 2017. How did you guys first meet?
We had some mutual friends in the game. I was at Coastal Carolina, and he was it was funny because when the Florida Atlantic job opened up, these friends reached out to me and said, "Hey, you should apply for that job." And I said, "I don't think, with what I know about the politics, I felt like I was ready for the job, but I knew politically it probably wouldn't happen." But so we waited a couple of weeks, and then they called me back and said, "Hey, I know the guy who got the job. I can probably get you an interview with him." So I looked him up. I remember watching Jim's teams, Dayton teams, compete in the tournament. And I said, "Okay, at that point, I think my ambition for coaching became more about just connecting with good people rather than, rising in the game, climbing the ladder. I don't know if that was my intent. I just wanted to connect with good people. And when I talked to Jim, it was apparent that this was a good guy, no matter how successful he was, he just had this humbleness about him that I hadn't experience from people who had done 1% of what he did. So I knew I had to work with him. And, you know, that turned into us partnering over time, just, you know, just gained his trust. And, you know, before you knew it, we were family. Yeah. So it's been a great ride.
So when he moved to Siena, that was an easy choice for you to come with him, right?
I don't know if it was easy. It was in upstate New York, and we were in Boca Raton, Florida. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't easy. But, you know, it became apparent after I looked at other opportunities, had conversations with other people. You know, it brought me back to the reason why I connected with Jim in the first place, and it was because he was an awesome person. And I said, you know, I'm going to go reconnect with my guy, and you know, we'll let the chips fall where they may. And it was obviously a great decision.
How would you describe your coaching style?
My philosophy in coaching is there's only two kinds of players, trained and untrained. I don't necessarily believe in good or bad. They're either trained or they're untrained, and it's my responsibility to train them. So I want to give them every possibility, every opportunity to learn. And I want me and my staff to always think about how we can grow in the way that we teach and what we teach. And as far as the standards are concerned, we're always going to push towards the standard, but I always want the student athletes to feel like, you know, we're in their corner in terms of growing and developing them.
Yeah, this team has reached the MAC tournament semifinals the last 2 years. What's going to take to get over the hump to get to the championship game?
It'd be nice to stay healthy. And I think we had a depth problem last year that we hope to solve this year. So I think we just need to be a little deeper, be a little healthier, be a little stronger. We have the experience having gone through last year. So if we had any experience concerns, we should have solved. Maybe we solved a little bit of that just with the natural progression of our players. So I think the experience, a little bit more depth, and, you know, we just continue to get 1% better in everything we do, and we should be right where we need to be when we need to be there.
Yeah. You've also coached in the men's college basketball at Division II, Palm Beach, Atlantic University. What differences do you see in coaching men versus women?
You know, it's funny. I don't know if I see a difference. Because when I was coaching men, I started to see a transition. Those guys needed a lot more support than I think the generation before them needed. And so coming over to the women's side, I now see that there are young ladies that have a strong passion for the game, kind of like the guys do. Whereas before, I didn't grow up around a lot of females who wanted to play sports, but I've seen I've seen this explosion in terms of, you know, just that competitive spirit, that passion for the game, love for the game. So it's been kind of cool. I almost feel like it parallels in a lot of respects. And now we're starting to see the spoils of the game start to be injected into the women's game, where men have had it a lot longer. So you start to see some of the aspects that come along with that. But I don't know. You know, it's funny. When I started coaching women, I remember asking a Power 5 coach for perspective on how to coach women versus men. And she said, there is no difference. I think I probably take more of a relational approach to coaching now that I coach the young ladies, because I always want them to understand why our approach is the way that it is. And I know that the stronger you are in communicating that message, no matter if it's boys or girls, the better relationship you have with the player. So,
yeah, you mentioned about some of the things that, you know, with women's basketball, you know, sort of coming along with the men's basketball. One of those is the transfer portal. How much does the transfer portal make your job recruiting that much tougher?
I don't know if it makes it tougher. You know, our jobs, we love what we do. So whether it's hard or easy, I don't know. if I factor in that much, we love it. So we're willing to do whatever it takes. And, you know, it's what the game is. And, you know, it's up to us to continuously evolve and develop and grow. So I see it as an opportunity. You know, I actually love the fact that players have, you know, some say in what they can do from 1 year to the next. And so I support it wholeheartedly. And it's just another resource for us. And if we get into the portal and we find, because I think Siena is just an amazing place. It's a very special place. And so I don't think we go to the portal just to find a talented player. I think we have to still find a kid that fits the Siena values. And we can find it there, great. And if not, that's fine too. There's other places where we can get players, other sources where we can get players.
Yeah, another aspect of the popularity of women's college basketball has never been higher. Yeah, thank Caitlin Clark for that. Thank LSU, South Carolina. Yeah, what we saw at MVP Arena a couple weeks ago with the tournament here, just the sold-out crowds and the excitement. How much does Caitlin Clark get credit for what we have seen now in women's college basketball?
You have to give it to her, right? It was sort of a perfect storm, too, because I remember when she came into the game, there were a couple of players that were right there with her, and she just kind of emerged over time. So you got to give her flowers. And I talk about this a lot with our girls. You know, it's one thing to enjoy the spoils, right? But I don't think people realize how hard that young lady worked to get to where she is. And I hope that's the example that a lot of people take from it. But, no, we've enjoyed it. We've enjoyed the increased exposure for the women's game. And we hope to really capitalize on it. We have some amazing young ladies over here at Siena that pour their hearts into what they do for the program and for the college and for Siena Nation as a whole. So we hope that if just a fraction of the percentage that packed into the MVP arena, we hope for some of those guys to come over to our program to support it. It's going to be a fun ride.
Yeah, I was there for the LSU-Iowa regional championship game, and I had a good view of Caitlin Clark's first three-pointers, like 10 feet in front of me. I'm just watching. It's like, oh, my God. And some of her passes, like, wow. I just like, yeah. She is the real deal.
Yeah, and that's just not natural talent. She puts in a ton of time, a ton of work, and unfortunately that kind of gets lost in the translation of the moment. But I wish that there were time to promote that a little more, because that's the part that people need to see and understand as well.
Who are your coaching influences?
I think everybody was. Anybody that won a championship was my coaching influence, and probably most of those guys ended up losing at some point. So, you know, I got a chance to see both sides. It's almost too many to name, from being honest, but I'll have it kind of spear into a conversation about Jim, because Jim was the last mentor that I had prior to getting this position. But it's so interesting between coaches and players how many folks can influence you, you know, from the guys that you see on television every day, that you get to go to clinics to listen to, and Lord knows I've been to a ton of them, to even some of your players, you know, and even to some high school folks. I've been recruiting in high school gyms and have been influenced by coaches. So, you know, I'm always, you know, whether it's any source that I can get good information, I'm going to get it. You know, I could be driving to work, listen to a podcast, YouTube videos. This conversation, can you say something that, you know, that triggers me? I'm writing it down, probably going to use it, you know. So I don't think I can, you know, just point to one or two people. But I think that all of those experiences culminate into my interaction with Jim.
Were you a big Pistons fan growing up in Detroit?
Absolutely. Well, I thought I was the Pistons growing up in Detroit. You know what I'm saying? When they won the championship, I ran out of the house and fell on my knees in prayer and tears. You know what I'm saying? I thought I was right there with them. I couldn't stand Michael Jordan until I grew up and understood the impact that he had on the game. Could not stand the guy. You know what I'm saying? Love the Jordan rules. As a matter of fact, you know, those Bad Boy Piston influences carried out into the outdoor courts of Detroit. You know, so there was a lot of flagrant foul going on in Detroit at that time.
They weren't flagrant at the time. They were illegal. They were legal.
That's right. Very much so. Yeah. As a matter of fact, they were almost prescribed. If you were in a certain situation of the game, especially game points, you had to almost be a pro wrestler to win that game because you were going to get fouled beyond understanding.
Well, Terry, I appreciate a few minutes. We'll talk during the season. Good luck with everything, and enjoy the rest of the offseason and prepare for the upcoming season.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks for the time. Really appreciate it.
Coming up, we'll talk the Buffalo Sabres with Joe Yurden of Noted Hockey. The Sabres missed the playoffs for the 13th straight year, and that cost head coach Don Granato his job. We'll talk to Joe about that and what's in store for the Sabres as they search for a new head coach. You're listening to the Parting Shots Podcast.
Hi. I'm Daily Gazette news columnist Andrew Waite and host of the Weighing In podcast, which takes you inside my award-winning featured news column by offering the backstory, thought process, and interviews that inform my work. Plus, readers have their chance to respond. The Weighing In podcast is available at dailygazette.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Daily Gazette sports writer Mike McAdam. You're listening to the Parting Shots podcast with Daily Gazette sports editor Ken Schott.
Welcome back to the podcast, and the Buffalo Sabres are not in the playoffs once again, and that cost Don Granato his job. To talk about that and what the future holds for the Sabres is our friend Joe Yurden from Noted Hockey. Joe, what happened to the Sabres?
Well, it's been fascinating learning a little bit more here with locker clearouts and players commenting on things, because and you know what it's like being on a beat and, you know, being only able to see so much in front of you and what's going on and, you know, what the players tell you, what the coaches tell you, and just kind of having to just be like, okay, well, that's what you said. All right. What we're finding out is that things were kind of a little bit too cozy for the players, and accountability was a major problem. And I mean, I suppose we could have watched what was going on the ice and seeing, you know, bad starts constantly, the power play being a nightmare, the inability to win more than three games in a row at a time. You know, I think they did it, what, twice this year? They won three games and never anything more. So many little things just seem to pile up on them. And, you know, for the good things that the things they're able to improve on from last season, the negatives managed to find a way to outweigh it and brought them down, and it took them down in a year where the Eastern Conference was maybe it was a little bit easier. I don't want to say easier, but, you know, the point total you needed to get in the playoffs was a little bit lower than it was last year. So disappointing, really disappointing. And, you know, for as young of a group as it is, you know, Kevin Adams made it very clear in talking about firing Don Granato that, you know, I don't want to hear anything more about them being young. Their experience, they might be young in age, but they've, you know, some of these guys have hundreds of games in the league already. So it's time for that talk to stop. And I think that's the right approach. You know, Don tried to try to, you know, hit on that, but every now and again, I would be like, well, you know, what do you, you know, some of these guys, they need this experience and, you know, whatever. But it's difficult, and it's got the fan bases. Really bad. Fan base is really mad because we're on 13 years now without a playoff spot. And in the NHL, that's bonkers.
Yeah.
It's absolutely bonkers.
Yeah, this day and age, it is crazy. I mean, just reading the quotes and from Kevin Adams, he seemed just ticked off. Was that the way you saw it?
Yeah. Yeah. It was cutting through a lot of, I don't want to say BS, but it was cutting through a lot of like the buzzwords and some of the want to say it's like necessarily marketing talk, but a lot of what has built up over the years about coming out of them rebuilding. I don't know how many re's go in front of rebuilding at this point, but what they started doing after trading Jack Eichel and Sam Reinhart and Rasmus Ristolainen and what they're building now with Alex Tuck and Tage Thompson and Rasmus Dahlin and Jack Quinn and Dylan Cousins, like all these younger guys, what they're doing now, you know, a lot of it was kind of trying to temper expectations and build hope, you know, which, I mean, you know, selling hope can be a tricky thing to do.
Yeah.
Because if you don't follow through, everybody's like, well, lied to again. Well, disappointed again. And this time around, I think Adams was just kind of like, listen, we got to get it right. And it's time for this group that is young in age, but not inexperienced to kind of grow up and to learn how to take that next step, which you thought would have happened this season after how close they got last year. But, you know, some of those issues managed to hang around, apparently, which, you know, kind of makes us on the beat look a little dumb for not really just kind of being like, hey, it's, doesn't look right. This seems like a lot of the same stuff, but when, you know, I guess when you're told one thing and you're trying to be critical about it, you know, it can get kind of turned on you, and you know, coach just starts, you know, making you look bad or whatever, or somebody says something and you're just like, oh, okay, well, I guess I'm the jerk, but I mean, I'm used to getting called that online, but hey, whatever. But it's fascinating hearing guys talk about this, and even the players today were like, you know, we know accountability is a buzzword, and it's a word we've heard here multiple times in multiple years about how they need more of it. But this is the first time this group has run into it where it's like, hey, you know, maybe we needed somebody to hold our feet to the fire a little bit harder, and to push things more, and to punish guys when they're not keeping up, or, you know, whether it's benching them, putting them in the press box, whatever it was, they needed more of that. And they didn't need the standard to slip. And it sounded like that was the issue this year, was that the standard started to slip, and some guys were able to get away with things. And that's what will cost you. That's, you know, hearing Kevin Adams talk about how they weren't able to compete consistently is a wild thing to hear. After a season in which, you know, they were a point away from the, you know, a point out of a playoff spot a year ago, and this year they're going to finish what, you know, 6-7 points out, I mm-hmm. guess. But, you know, it's wild to hear, like, well, you know, some night there was more nights than not where we just weren't able to keep up, for a team with as much talent as they have, and as young as they are, to be able to say, like, well, you know, what are you going to do? Some nights we had it, but a lot of nights we didn't. That for me, if I'm a fan, would have me raging about it.
Did Granato change the team's style of play? I mean, I was reading where they went defensive and, you know, sort of went got away from the offensive game.
Yeah, you know, that question was very pointedly asked of Adams, and he said, you know, listen, our system did not change. You know, the offense went quieter. The power play was a major issue. I cannot repeat the word major enough before saying it was an issue. The power play cost in playoffs, as far as I'm concerned. I wrote about this yesterday. Wish I had the number committed in my memory. I'm going to have it burn in my brain, you know, after this week. But I think the power play scored like 27 fewer goals this season.
Wow.
Than they did a year ago. And that's even considering that the power play kind of went cold halfway through last season, and they just kind of kept at it. It kept being the same thing. And even, you know, talking with Dahlin today, Rasmus Dahlin, about it today, he was very much just kind of like, you know, we gotta, he's like, our power play was basically like, just feed it to Tage. And we're like, yeah, we know, we watched it. That's, that's all it was like, get the puck to Tage, let him shoot. I mean, you know, listen, he had 20 power play goals a year ago. I get it. But when the other teams are stacking guys on top of him and shadowing him closely and making sure that either he can't get a pass or he can't get the shot away, you got to figure it out. And you have more guys than them. Find another way. And they just never – there was never any sort of noticeable way to do that. And if it wasn't that, they weren't able to get in the zone, all kinds of stuff like that. And, you know, it made it look like they were trying to change the way they were playing hockey. But truth was, that was not the case at all. I mean, yes, they were, you know, they were trying to become more defensively responsible, which they needed to be. They gave up a ton of goals last year. But, you know, Tage Thompson says to us today that, you know, he sees this team as a high flying team that can score a ton of goals, which I do agree with. We saw it in the second half, but you know, he even owned up. He said, you know, when he hurt his hand halfway, you know, early in the season, and he said, I probably came back too soon. And I knew it was going to, he said he knew it was going to take time for him to come back, to get back to what he was. It took a lot longer. And, you know, the Tage we saw in the second half was a lot closer to the guy that we saw last year and the year before. But sometimes hurrying back like that, and, you know, listen, I get it. You know, you get into a desperate spot and you're looking to string wins together and you're like, kind of in a hole. I got to get back. I got to help the guys out. I get it. But, you know, if you're fighting it when you're coming back and, you're not able to handle the puck well, can't get your shots off the way you want, all that stuff. It's tough to be able to kind of face up to that and say, like, you know, maybe I should wait a little bit. That's hard. That's really hard because these guys are ruthlessly competitive. But like, you know, things like that pile up. You know, they didn't really address Jack Quinn, you know, blowing out his Achilles in the summer by adding anybody and, you know, different things like that. It was almost like when we heard about Quinn's injury at the draft in Nashville last summer, it was like, uh-oh. You know, it was a little foreboding because it's like, uh-oh, okay, well, let's see how they address it. And they didn't add anybody. You know, they kind of left it as an open competition with all the young guys they've got. And, they got a very surprise occurrence seeing Zach Benson, you know, earning a spot out of camp, which is, you know, which is kind of wild in its own. But a lot of the guys that people, you know, a lot of us thought might take that step up, whether it was Matt Savoy or Yuri Kulik or Isak Rosé, and those guys weren't able to really step into it yet. And, you know, Seth Appert's done well with them in Rochester and developing them. But, you know, I think next year you're looking at, not that they want to be any younger of a team, but it's kind of unavoidable because, you know, one or two of those guys are going to be in the running to get a spot on this team. And, you know, man, it's wild because these guys are super talented, but, you know, when you're adding really green guys to the NHL, you know, pretty steadily, that's guys learning on the job how to be pros, and that could be tough.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Seth Appert, the former RPI coach. He's been doing well with the Rochester Americans, the Sabres AHL affiliate. His name was mentioned in one story, but I think from what Kevin Adams said, he wants somebody with experience. So, you know, Seth Appert, does he have any shot at this job?
I don't think he's got a shot at the head coaching job. Seth has done such a great job in Rochester, and they love the work that he does with working with these guys. The development work, helping these guys along, and you see the progress these guys make during the course of a season down there, and it's extremely noticeable, you know, especially with guys that it's their first year. I think back to when JJ Paterka and Jack Quinn, you know, their first year at Rochester, and, you know, both those guys were kind of like, all right, in the first month or two. Once they caught it, they took off, and they were brilliant players down there. And, you know, a big part of that was Michael Pekka as an assistant coach, kind of getting through to him, being like, hey, no, the offense is great, guys, but you better learn how to back check. Better learn how to match up defensively, or else you're going to be playing here the rest of your life. But it's Seth who's able to work with these guys, and he's such a player's coach. Like, he holds them to task, but like he has the kind of guiding hand that allows these players to learn on the job and grow and to earn their way into the lineup, and that's a big deal for them. And he's done so well with it that it would be difficult for them. Like, they would have to have somebody else that they know for sure could step into that role and be able to do the same thing if they moved him up to be the head coach. But they might still have to do that because it's, in my mind, Seth could be moved up and become an assistant coach in Buffalo next season. In my, you know, again, this is just my take on it. This is not me knowing anything or whatever, but But, I mean, Seth is on that path. He's going to be an NHL head coach at some point in the future. But, you know, he got a taste of it this year when he stepped in for Don for a couple of games while he was out sick. He's going to be on an NHL bench at some point. And, you know, you see the success he's had with the Amerks, and they've been really good. They've got a really good team again this year. They're going to the playoffs. He's going to be somebody's number one at some point. And I don't think it's going to come yet, but I think the Sabres would be wise to try to make sure he doesn't get out of their hands, because they've got somebody who's on an upward trajectory right now. And, you know, if they, you know, whoever they hire to be the head coach, and it's got to be somebody with NHL experience. It's got to, you know, everybody gets kind of caught up about, you know, retread coaches, but they need somebody who's been there, who's been through it, that knows how to get the best out of the guys.
Yeah, I saw Lindy Ruff's name mentioned. I mean, can he come back? I mean, is that feasible?
I think there might have to be a sit down with Lindy and Terry Pegula to kind of go over how things went in 2013 when they let him go. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe, but I think there's a very strong possibility Lindy Ruff comes back. He interviewed for the head coaching job in 2019. Jason Botra brought him in to talk about it, and they passed on him because they felt he wasn't the right fit at that point, you know, which at that point it was, you know, Sam Reinhart, Jack Eichel, all that stuff. And, you know, again, trying to get in the playoffs and do whatever. And I don't know if the thought for that was, you know, well, maybe Lindy's a little too old for this. Well, he showed in New Jersey he can still coach.
Yeah.
He got completely snowed by the bad goaltending there this year. And, you know, maybe Tom Fitzgerald didn't do him any favors, you know, to try to fix that up. But, I mean, that was a 112 point team a year ago, you know, and they played fast. They were able to score. It reminded me a lot of his Sabres teams in 06, 07, 07, 08. Very similar to that. And, you know, maybe having a couple of young goalies in Ukko-Pekka Luukkonen and Devin Levi might drive him a little crazy, but they're both good. They're both really good. So maybe it'll be okay for him to deal with that. But I think the chances are very high that Lindy Ruff comes back to Buffalo and coaches his team again.
If not Lindy, then who?
That's where it gets a little hazy. I think we're all kind of rightfully distracted by Lindy, because it seems almost automatic, because Kevin Adams was his assistant coach at the end of his tenure in Buffalo. So, I mean, it's, you know, that seems like a layup, but if it's not Lindy, I think the list gets really interesting after that. I think Craig Berube is going to be pretty high on that list. You know, won a Stanley Cup with St. Louis, is a hard guy. You know, he demands a lot out of his guys. I think that's somebody who checks a lot of those boxes. I think you're looking at, you know, Bruce Boudreau's name's going to be out there, because, I mean, he's been there. Everybody talks about, you know, he doesn't win in the playoffs. Well, Sabres just need to get to the playoffs.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, if he gets there and they don't win, it's like, well, whatever. The counter's been reset, so we'll work on winning next year. But his name will be out there. Who else? I would keep an eye on Mike Sullivan if Pittsburgh walks away from him. I think he would be a very strong candidate for that. There's some other names. Oh, Gerard Gallant, Alex Tuch was talking him up to. He had him in Vegas when he played there, and he said, you know, hey, you know, he loved playing for him. You know, he said he was hard, but he was fair, and he trusted. He trusted you. Like, if he was tough on you, it was because he knew that he could. He's like, he might yell at you on the bench, but he'd be putting you back out for your next shift, knowing that, okay, I got through to you. You know how to do this. So,
But he seems to wear out his welcome quickly for wherever he's gone. That's the amazing thing.
Yeah, and I think the issue that came up with him with the Rangers, when things you know, went away there, I think it was he had a lot of young players to deal with, and I think there was a lot of bristling. And I think that's frustrating for a coach too, because, like, some coaches are good at handling that and bringing guys along and, you know, being a guiding hand for them in the NHL. I think Gallant's a guy that wants everybody to already know what they're supposed to do. He doesn't want to. I don't think he wants to do a ton of, you know, guiding hand kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Where, you know, he's got to be a teacher and a coach. I think he just wants to coach. He wants to, you know, work the guys in practice, work them hard, and, you know, and coach him through the games. I think for a veteran team, he's a great guy to pick from. Now, maybe his personality rubs people the wrong way, but, like, you know, stuff happens. I mean, he was a tough SOB as a player.
Yeah.
I mean, he was able to score. He scored a pretty good amount, but, man, he did not back down from anybody. Yeah. He was a hard player. But, you know, maybe that's where I think Seth Appert as an assistant becomes a viability, because whoever comes in is going to be tougher. Like, they're going to be more of a, you know, not, I say hardhead because I don't want to use other words for it, but, you know, but, like, it's going to be a more demanding coach in place. And I think Seth comes in and he can be the good cop for that. Again, can be stern with guys when he needs to. But I think if you have, like, a good cop, bad cop sort of dynamic, Seth being the good cop in that would make a lot of sense, especially with younger guys.
It's still amazing me. You mentioned Craig Berube. I mean, I'm old enough. I covered Craig Berube at the Hershey Bears, and we know what his role was in both the AHL and the National Hockey League. He was a fighter. I never envisioned him. Never envisioned him as a coach, head coach. Never. He was a funny guy, but he worked his way. I mean, he definitely, as you said, he won the Stanley Cup with the St. Louis Blues. Got the first Blues coach to win a cup there, and he's. I mean, he did coach the Flyers, and I don't know if he had the right, you know, the players there at the time. And, of course, the Flyers are going through their own situation and, you know, choking away their playoff opportunity. I'm sorry, am I a better Flyers fan? Nah.
Well, you've got the hardest guy in hockey right now coaching them.
Yeah.
Now, but you know what? But it's that sort of thing. I mean, it's funny. I think if Torts was available – I know people here would be screaming, get him in here, get him here. He's the guy. They need somebody to, you know, put a boot in their rear end. But I think they would love to have somebody out of that kind of mold, but not necessarily that aggressive about it. You know, you need somebody to kind of toe the line with that. And, I don't know how well Lindy did with that in New Jersey. I mean, there was talk of him, you know, Alex Holtz being in his doghouse, and, you know, kind of getting, you know, stuck down the lineup. But, like, that stuff happened in Buffalo before. I mean, I'm pretty sure it happened in Dallas too. Where if there's a guy that they feel he isn't getting the effort out of, like, you got to work twice as hard to win him back over. So, for some of the guys in Buffalo, if they need, it sounds like the leaders here with the Sabres, on the ice, not in the front office. Well, the front office too, I guess, too. But they want somebody who's going to be able to say, like, hey, you're not pulling your weight, man. Like, you're going to sit until you figure it out. And if you want to sit and sulk about it, okay, cool. But you're not going to get out there. And I think they kind of want to have somebody that's going to be able to do that and not back down and you know, just kind of be loose with everything.
Who'd you like to win a Stanley Cup?
Man, you know, I want to say it's going to be somebody out of the West, but I think the Western teams are going to beat each other's heads in. I think the West is going to be a meat grinder for everybody out there. Cause I really like what Vancouver's got going on. I think Tockett's done a great job with them. But it's really hard to look away from Vegas, especially, you know, I think Thomas Hertl comes back late in the season. Mark Stone started practicing as soon as the schedule's winding down. You're like, okay, Vegas shenanigans again. I mean, listen, every team could do that, but, you know, Vegas is kind of like, yeah, whatever, you know, we're doing it. It's not against the rules, so go ahead and stop us. But Dallas really impresses me, but they're going to get Vegas in the first round probably. So, like, you know, that's not fun. I mean, if Dallas gets LA in the first round, I really like Dallas to do it. I think they got a taste of it last year. They lose to Vegas in the Western final. And that stuck with them because they were playing really well. But I love the makeup of the Stars. And if Ottinger turns it on, forget it.
Yeah.
They're going to be really tough to beat. The East is a little messy. I know the Rangers won the President's Trophy, all that stuff, but, like, I don't know. Like, Panarin's having a great year. Shesterkin's incredible. You know, and if he slides a little bit, John Quick's been great too, which is nuts. I can't believe how good he's been there, backing up Shesterkin. But I do like a lot of what's going on with the Rangers, but something about it doesn't sit right with me. Mm-hmm. But I think if you, I, I think if I have to pick somebody out of the East, I think it's Florida. But, like, they got to deal with Tampa first round. Tampa's got their flaws, but I don't – that's not a team I want to see in the first round of the playoffs. I definitely – I mean, I'm sure Toronto's happy not to deal with them again in the first round, but they get Boston. Like, good luck, man. Yeah. Keep waiting for the Leafs to take a step, and Matthews is having an awesome year. But the Bruins, first round, and they're still good, and they're mad about how they went out last year. Like, it's messy. But I think if it's a Florida-Dallas Cup final, I think – I love the way Florida plays. I love the way Dallas plays, but I think it's supposed to be Dallas this year.
Interesting. So, well, can't wait. Can't wait for the, even though my Flyers aren't there, well, I'm going to watch. So, Joe, appreciate a few minutes. And once the Sabres find their new coach, maybe we'll chat again.
Yeah, we'll have to circle back. Yeah, keep your Lindy Ruff notes handy, though. I think that's going to be the guy.
All right. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Ken.
All right, that's Joe Yordan from Noted Hockey. Coming up, we'll talk with the New York Post columnist Mike Vaccaro on a very variety of New York sports topics, including the retirement of John Sterling. You're listening to the Parting Shots podcast.
Favorite high school sports memory? A late inning rally? A game winning shot? A photo finish? Maybe it's a pep rally or a pregame ritual. Maybe it's the euphoria of a late night bus ride home after a hard fought win. Maybe it's having pizza with teammates after the game. Now, imagine if it never happened at all. School sports need your help. With budgets getting tighter, it's more than the games that are on the line. It's all the traditions, the community pride, the culture of your hometown high school, plus all those memories that are on the line, too. What can you do? It's simple. Buy a ticket when you can. Go to a game. Take the whole family. Let's do everything we can to keep those cherished school sports memories alive.
This message presented by the New York State Public High School Athletic Association and the New York State Athletic Administrators Association.
Hi, this is Daily Gazette sports writer Stan Hooey. You're listening to the Parting Shots podcast with Daily Gazette sports editor Ken Shaw.
Welcome back to the podcast, and we're going to talk some New York sports. And one of the best in the business is the columnist for the New York Post, Mike Vaccaro, and he's making his debut on the Parting Shots podcast. Mike, appreciate a few minutes, and how are things down in New York?
Ken, it's cloudy, but it's not raining, so I guess we'll take this. We'll take the trade off.
Oh, I'm tired of the rain. Trust me, it's been crazy. Yeah, but well, we had some surprising news on Monday with John Sterling announces his retirement. I mean, I know he's been cutting back on his schedule the last couple of years, but this sort of came out of the blue. I mean, how shocked were you when you heard the announcement?
Well, I guess on one level, not so shocked because he's been cutting back his schedule, and the man is 86 years old, or is going to be 86 years old. So, you know, God bless him for being able to stay in the press box that long. But I think it's surprising just because whatever you think of listening to the Yankees on the radio, you think of John Sterling. I mean, an entire generation, maybe two generations of people, that's how they got their baseball at the beach during the last couple of summers, in the car, you know, in the same way that Mel Allen was for another generation of Yankees fans. And, you know, Red Barber was for a generation of Dodgers fans and Yankees fans. I mean, you know, Sterling really was the voice of that team. And we're going to miss him. I don't think his style was universally admired by every listener. But I'll tell you what, it was unique. It was his own voice, and I can assure you, as somebody who was lucky enough to grow up to call him a friend, he was one of the nicest people that you'll ever meet in a press box anywhere.
Yeah, because you.
And he was.
Yeah, you mentioned.
He genuinely loved the job, and he really was humbled by how much people loved the way he did that job.
Yeah, he was one of, I think, the last few baseball play-by-play guys to not take until in the last couple of years, to take any time off. I mean, you had to drag him away to get me. And the baseball announcers today, you know, they'll take some time, maybe a week or two off. I mean, I grew up in Philadelphia. I mean, Harry Callis and Richie Ashburn were my voices of Phillies baseball, and you know, they never took a time off. Maybe Harry would, you know, do a Sunday football game to be away. But for the most part, John basically was there for 162 games and no days off. I mean, that to me is just, in this day and age, is incredible.
And that was one of the things he was most proud of, is, you know, he would say every now and again when we talk in the dining room before a game, he'd say, "Michael, just another day's work." And he appreciated the workers in the media industry who showed up for work every day and who did their jobs and did them well. And he was certainly the patron saint of those kind of people, because he punched the clock every day. He enjoyed every inning, he enjoyed every pitch, and I think that came through the radio speaker. It was really fun to listen to how much fun he was having.
Yeah, I mean, the home run calls, obviously people associate him with that. Some love it and some hate it. You wrote a column, I think, in 2019 about the how he goes through that. I mean, talk about how he developed that.
Yeah, I mean, look, it started innocently enough. It started just with him, you know, exploding after a big Bernie Williams hit back in the day. And I believe he went with both Bernie Goes Boom and Burn, Burn, Bernie Burn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's attentive enough to know when people respond to that. You know, I mean, even the whole Yankees win thing, the way he did it, I mean, that was an accident. Just in the heat of a big postseason win, he just went with the Yankees win. And people liked it, and so he was not averse. You know, he wasn't one of these rock singers who doesn't want to play the hits. He was always going to play the hits, and seeing how people responded to that Bernie Williams nickname, he went with it with just about every players that came through after that. And you know, the column you're referring to, I think he had just come up with one for Mike Ford, who was passing through town that season. And, you know, we just talked about, you know, the way he goes about it. He tries to make it accessible. But, you know, one of the interesting things about John is that he's so well-versed and well-rounded. And, you know, he's a man who loves the theater, and he loves, you know, 40s music and 50s music and, you know, 1930s movies. And, you know, I mean, sometimes his first thoughts would go with the things that he liked, and maybe people didn't realize what he was doing. Obviously, would adjust on the fly.
Yeah,
and I thought that was kind of funny that he would realize that not everybody maybe knew the words to every Billie Holiday song, so he'd have to kind of move on to something a little more modern, and he would, you know. And so that was fantastic, and that was a lot of fun to spend some time. It was always fun for me to spend time with John, because he was such an engaging person and such an enjoyable he's such enjoyable company. But for him to kind of like go, you know, break through how he break down, I had come up with, I believe it was Ford Tough, and there was something else in that he called him. Called him a couple of things, you know, playing off his last name of Ford. And, you know, it was just to see that kind of developing in real time was kind of neat.
And you mentioned in a post on X on Monday about, I think a lot of people my age, I mean, I barely remember this, but he was the voice of the New York Islanders early on, and when the Islanders scored, be Islander goal, Islander goal.
Yep, Islanders and the Nets for a while. Yeah. And as people pointed out to me, because this is before my time, even before the Islanders, he was the voice of the New York Raiders of the World Hockey Association. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where that goal was that goal call was born. He would say, "Raiders goal, Raiders goal." And that's what that developed into Islanders goal. And kind of one of the really neat things I thought was, you know, two young broadcasters paid tribute to him that night. Brendan Burke, who does the Islanders games for MSG, when the Islanders scored their fourth goal that night, he pulled a Islanders goal, and those of us who were watching of a certain age knew exactly what he was doing. I remember reaching out to him and congratulating him on that, and he was happy that people noticed. And out in California, Wayne Randazzo, who used to be one of the radio voices of the Mets here for a number of years, he does Angels games now.
Yeah.
And I don't know who the player was, but when somebody hit a home run, he did the signature, "It is high, it is far, it is gone." And, you know, that tells you the reach he had. You know, he wasn't just popular among fans. He was also, you know, influential among his fellow broadcasters. And I'm not sure there's a higher compliment that can be paid to anybody.
Yeah, I heard him a little bit on the Tiki Barber show on FAN on Monday, just listening on the phone, and he sounds well. I mean, is there any health concerns with him?
Michael Kay, who's known him for a long time, was his longtime broadcast partner when they were both on the radio. He said on the show that it's more just a fatigue thing. He just, there comes a point where I think it becomes less important to you to go to work as opposed to just enjoying, your life. And so, who knows? I mean, I don't think anybody necessarily wants to invade John's privacy and ask him directly if there was any issues. But, I mean, at least according to that, it seems like it's more of a situation where he's just ready to pass the baton to the new generation.
I mean, I know the Ford Fricker winner for this year is announced, but what about for him for next year?
At some point, I think. Look, I mean, if you're gonna identify those who are, surgically attached to the game thanks to their voices, which is essentially what that award honors, I think he definitely belongs in. I think. Look, I mean, he's got a fairly sizable amount of detractors, and I'm sure they can give you, that side of the coin. And is he necessarily, as enjoyable to listen to a game to as Vin Scully? Well, it depends on who you're. What's your preference? Some people like Vin Scully. Some people like John Sterling. Some people like Marv Albert. Some people don't. I mean, you can be very subjective about the people who call the games, but I don't think there's any denying the impact he had, the staying power he had, the work ethic he had, and the fact that this man was associated intricately with the most famous baseball team in the world. And I think that's all you need to know for, his qualifications for that award. I would agree with you.
Speaking of the world's most famous baseball team in the world, the Yankees off to a pretty good start. As we talk here on the Wednesday, then they have an afternoon game against Toronto. By the time this airs, the result will be known. But 12-6, off to a good start in the American League East. How much pressure is on Aaron Boone this year to get this team back to the playoffs?
Well, there's pressure from external forces because I think there have been a lot of fans who have grown weary with him, even though, I mean, I'm not one of them. I mean, I've written regularly over the time that it's not easy to win as many games as he's won. I mean, he's averaged something like 95 or 96 wins for every 4 year that he had going into last year. Last year was obviously a tough one for a lot of different reasons. So certainly among the fan base, I think there's some externally applied pressure. But he's got the support of his general manager, of his owner. I'll be surprised, barring a complete collapse, if there would be a, problem with that. But, the Yankees' job is the Yankees' job. So if this thing turns south and he winds up with a second straight less than successful season, I think, maybe we might have a different conversation. But, I think he's a terrific manager. I really do. I mean, I've watched, probably, 700 other games he's managed. And I can tell you, it's a tough job anyway. It's a really tough job now because you have a lot of voices in your head telling you this, telling you that. Mm-hmm. And look, it's the Yankees. Getting to the playoffs. You don't get a dish of ice cream. Good for you and good job. In the Yankees, you gotta make the World Series. You gotta win the World Series. And the Yankees haven't won the World Series in 15 years. And I guess there are some teams that will say, well, my heart bleeds, but for the Yankees, look, I mean, for better or worse, their mission statement every year is to win the World Series. Yeah. And ultimately that cost Joe Girardi his job even a year after he took him to the ALCS. And, ultimately if Aaron Boone doesn't get to that plateau, it's going to cost him. I just don't think we've arrived at that point yet.
Yeah, unfortunately, they beat my Phillies there in 2009, so I'm not over that one yet. like I said, I'm a Philly native, I bleed
understood.
Everything. Yeah, so.
Understood.
Meanwhile, the Mets, not too bad so far. How would you assess their start?
I mean, definitely resilient. Look, they started 0-5, and the furor that was surrounding that was almost beyond belief. People already asking if Carlos Mendoza was over his head, wondering who was going to get started to, when the fire sale was going to start. And, when you start bad in New York, it is a different dynamic. I always kind of think that the New York media thing is overblown, but I also understand that it's a harder place to play than certain markets. And when you start the season 0-5, you know, as somebody pointed out when that happened, you know, every team in baseball last year, including the world champions, including the two teams in the World Series, everybody has a 5-game losing streak. Mm-hmm. It happened in August. You know, it's maybe cause for alarm. It's not cause for panic. But it's like the players start the season 1-30. You know, it just looks bad when you go up to the scoreboard and you're hitting, you know, 0-27. And when you're 0-0-0, it was tough for the Mets. But I give them a lot of credit because, you know, they bounced back from that 0-5 start. They're 9-8 as you and I are speaking, and they're up against the Pirates late in the game Wednesday afternoon. So there's a good chance they're going to get to 10-8. This is after the 0-5 start. And this has been against, you know, the last three teams. They've won three series in a row, and it's four series in a row against teams with winning records. I mean, the teams that they're beating have a collective winning percentage over 600, which is amazing when you consider the fact that they started the season 0-5.
So, yeah.
You know, it was important for the Mets to be able to change that narrative, and really important for them to kind of get into April where they're playing, you know, representative baseball. So you're talking about that stuff and not the other nonsense and not having anything from last year carry over. And it really does look like they're, you know, they had a really tough chemistry issue last year, I think. And it seems right now that that's not a problem right now. They do seem to have great chemistry. They seem to get along, seem to play hard for the manager. And, you know, despite the 0-5 start, they're really actually in a pretty good place, I think.
Yeah. I think the people have that football mentality. They think baseball is a 18-week season, which is not. Obviously, you know, there's plenty of time to catch up, and I think people tend to forget that.
It's so true. And, I mean, I know it's still this that way in New York. I think it's this way a lot of places. What you just, the way you described it is perfect, the football mentality. You know, look, in football, you can spend 6 days obsessing over a win or a loss. And it's understandable because you don't play any other games. But it's that way in New York. When the Knicks go on a 3-game losing streak, it's like the sky is falling in. But look, New York is a baseball town. And so when even the Mets and the Yankees are scuffling, you know, it's a lot. Sometimes it's hard to kind of rise to 30,000 feet and kind of try and look at the big picture. But that's also what makes it so much fun. You know, people are up and down. They're hot and cold. They want this guy fired. Then they want a manager of the year. You know, sometimes it's in the same game. And yeah. To me, that's what makes it a lot of fun.
Well, you mentioned the Knicks. They are in the playoffs. The number two seed out of the Eastern Conference. Boston looks like the prohibitive favorite to win this thing. But can the Knicks make a run to the finals?
Look, I think they have a puncher's chance no matter who they play. And I think that's really all you're asking for. Look, I mean, they smoked the Celtics last week. Obviously, the Celtics had nothing to play for. The Knicks still had a lot to play for, so it's really hard to read a lot into that, but I don't think you necessarily read nothing into it either. Because the Celtics did play pretty hard for a half. They did try and put everything they knew at, you know, they threw everything they could at Jalen Brunson, and it didn't work. In fact, Brunson torched him for 39. You know, it's the elephant in the room is the fact that, you know, Julius Randle isn't going to come back, and he is their second best offensive player. And you would think in the playoffs that might come back to bite them, and I think they were able to overcome that over the course of the regular season because they just, frankly, just play harder than most teams. They play to win every single game. Their coach demands it. He's lucky enough to have a roster of players who it wouldn't even occur to them to take a night off unless they were hurt. And that's up and down the roster. I mean, there's no load maintenance on this team. They go after it every game. And that was evidenced by game 82. Look, I mean, the Cavaliers clearly tanked that game away. They didn't care about finishing high. The Sixers kind of tried to tank that game away, but we didn't try to tank, but they didn't care if they won or lost by sitting in B. The Knicks would never think about that. And midway through the fourth quarter, they're losing by 8, and word comes that Cleveland has lost, so they can't fall any lower than the third seed. But, you know, there are some places where they just would have kind of, you know, maybe called off the dogs and say, all right, this is good. And they not only fought to come back in that game, but they played 5 extra minutes and won in overtime. And it's an emblematic of who they are. Now, the reward for that is to either play the Sixers or the Heat. That's going to cause a lot of Knicks fans a lot of grief because both those teams will be difficult. But the way I answer that is that the way the East is this year outside of Boston, teams 2 through 8, and really you could probably include the Bulls in there at 9, any of those teams can beat each other 4-3, 4-7. Just can't. And so they're playing really well right now, and you have to trust that that's going to translate in the playoffs.
Yeah. It's going to be busy at MSG because the Rangers will be in the Stanley Cup playoffs starting this weekend. And the President's Trophy champion Rangers, I mean, that's a blessing or a curse. I mean, more of a curse in the NHL in the last few years. But, I mean, are the Rangers ready to win a cup for the first time since 94?
I don't see why not. I mean, they have the players. They have the coach. They're unbelievable on special teams. I mean, you know, when they're on the power play, it's like they're playing 10-on-4 a lot of times. And, you know, shorthanded, they're almost on the attack more often than they're not with all the shorties they score. And that's such a huge advantage in the playoffs, as is the fact that they have a world-class goaltender who's always capable of stealing a game here and there. And they're just a deep, talented team that does everything well. Now, so were the Bruins last year. And as you said, you know, the President's Cup was a nice parting gift for them after the first round.
Yeah.
So, and look, the Rangers and the Capitals have a history in the playoffs. So, you know, that's going to add a fresh element to things as well. Do they have the goods to get there? I think they do. I think it'll be a lot of fun in this city if the Islanders wind up meeting up at some point, which could certainly be something that would happen in round two if the Islanders survive the Hurricanes. I mean, that would be a nice old school, you know, series back to the 80s when it seemed like they would face each other every year.
Yeah.
And, That'd be a nice cap to it.
Of course, a lot of the talk about the Rangers is on Matt Rempe, the 6'7" forward who's getting a lot of fights. I mean, he's sort of an old school guy. I go back to when I grew up in Philadelphia with the Broad Street Bullies and Dave Schultz and Andre DuPont, Bob Kelly, and all those guys. I mean, is Rempe more than just a fighter?
By all accounts, he is. I mean, I think right now that's his role. He's kind of an enforcer type, but by all accounts, he's got some skills. I'm not going to pretend I'm Toe Blake and tell you that I noticed those skills, but people that I respect say that they think that he can be more than just a one dimensional player, and that's also a nice tool to have in your box.
Yeah,
at some point.
Over in Uniondale, the Islanders ended up making the playoffs. A coaching change midseason. Patrick Roy turned out to be the right move.
You know, and that's the thing. You know, the Canes had success against the Islanders. They beat them in the playoffs last year. But I'd be wary about this team because, I mean, there's no team in the world in the league that's hotter now. I mean, 2 weeks ago they looked dead in the water, and you know it was about eight games ago. You said, well, they pretty much have to win every night, and what do? They won every night except for one, and that one they went to overtime. So, you know, when you can get 15 points out of 8 games, when you pretty much need all those points, I mean, it tells you a little bit how hot they are. With two really good goaltenders, with some skill players, their problem is exactly the opposite of the Rangers. I mean, they're vulnerable as can be on the power play. They're vulnerable as can be shorthanded. I mean, that's the kind of thing that really tends to bite you in the playoffs, and so that's going to be their biggest impediment, I think.
Yeah, and I shouldn't have said Uniondale. That's old school. I mean, they're at Elmont now. That's my
Elmont.
Bad.
I knew what you were talking about.
Let's wrap this up quickly. Jets and Giants. What do you have to say about those two football teams?
Well, look, I mean, I think it's hard to know what to think about the Jets because, I mean, the wild card is the quarterback. You assume he's coming back. You assume that he'll be something resembling what he was in Green Bay. It's why last year was so damaging, because it was just a nothing year, because you didn't get a chance to utilize one of your Aaron Rodgers years, and you just didn't really move anything forward to see where you are. But if the quarterback comes back reasonably healthy, I think they could have a fun year. I mean, I'm not going to be one of these guys who tells you they're going to be in the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is still a conference that has Patrick Mahomes in it. It's still a conference that, it's still a division that has Josh Allen in it. And these are things that are going to be hard to overcome. But, I mean, do I think they can be in the playoff conversation in week 18 next year? I do. Do I think they can make the playoffs? Sure, why not? And then you take your chances from there. The Giants, excuse me. I do think the Giants are committed to the full rebuild. And I think that they just want to make sure that they get to a place when they're ready to win, that they can win. Now, that means a lot of moving pieces right now. I mean, they obviously took a step back last year, mostly because they had a much harder schedule than they did the year they went to the playoffs the year before. But they certainly have, have taken great strides. And I think what they need to do once and for all is identify whether it's the quarterback of the present or the quarterback of the future. And I think that'll become a lot more clear once they have the draft in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. How upset are the Giants fans that Saquon Barkley headed south on the Jersey Turnpike to Philadelphia?
Well, I mean, that's the way fans are. You know, I think, a lot of the same fans who were like, well, you can take or leave Saquon, they would have felt that same way if he would have wound up with the Chargers. But, look, I mean, it's like anything else. If a player for the Red Sox goes to play for the Yankees, it's not just, you're not just losing the player, you're also you're not just losing the player, but you're losing him to your arch rival, and that's you're kind of what this is. I mean, it's a little extra salty when you're talking about going from the Giants to the Eagles. I mean, that's just a blood rival, a blood feud, and I mean the cities hate each other to begin with, and those two fan bases really miss each other. So that makes that adds an extra element for sure. Yeah.
Well, Mike, where can people find you on X, formerly known as Twitter?
My handle is Mike Vack. My first name MIKE, then VACC.
And you're on Threads too, I believe, right?
I am. Mike Vack 67.
Okay. Well, Mike, appreciate a few minutes. I look forward to having you back on. This was a lot of fun.
Anytime. Great talking to you.
All right. That's Mike Vaccaro. We'll be back to wrap up the podcast and have the latest winners in the Daily Gazette's auto racing contest in just a moment. You're listening to the Parting Shots podcast.
If you really want to know what's going on in your community, you have to read the Daily Gazette. We don't take a side. We're right down the middle, and we're going to get to the truth. Our reporters and photographers are out in the field bringing you updates every minute with trust, accuracy, and integrity from the first page to the last page, independent, probing journalism. We're finding out what's going on in the community where nobody else is covering. It's who we are. It's what we do.
Frank Caliendo, pretending to be Morgan Freeman, maybe even a little bit of John Madden or Robert Downey Jr., comedian, impressionist, playboy, philanthropist, maybe not the last two. And you're listening to the Parting Shots podcast with Daily Gazette sports editor Ken Schott.
Back to wrap up the podcast. The Week 8 winner in the Daily Gazette's auto racing contest was Jameson Hayes of Mayfield with 60 points. Jameson wins a $50 gift card. Congratulations, Jameson. The VIP winner was Nick Platel, Grand Premier Tires, with 15 points. The Week 9 winner was Pamela LeBrake of Schenectady with 50 points. Pamela wins a $50 gift card. Congratulations, Pamela. The VIP winner was once again Nick Platel, Grand Premier Tires, with 20 points. I'll announce the auto racing contest winner's name, and that winner's name will appear in Saturday's Daily Gazette. To play, go to dailygazette.com and click on the auto racing contest banner. Just because COVID-19 mandates are easing, that does not mean you should relax. Be vigilant. If you have not gotten vaccinated or received a booster shot, please do so. Do it for yourself, do it for your family, and do it for your friends. That wraps up another edition of the Parting Shots podcast. I want to thank Terry Prim, Joe Yurden, and Mike Vaccaro for coming on the show. If you have questions or comments about the podcast, email them to me at shot, that's S-C-H-O-T-T, at dailygazette.com. Follow me on X and Threads at Slapshots. The views expressed on the Parting Shots podcast are not necessarily those of the Daily Gazette Company. The Parting Shots podcast is a production of the Daily Gazette Company. I'm Daily Gazette sports editor Ken Schott. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time. From the Parting Shots podcast studio in Schenectady, New York, good day, good sports.